Thank you. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Welcome. I titled this talk, The Clouds Clear When Krishna Speaks. Pretty clear today. Pretty sunny. Bhagavad Gita, as it is, most important book in Vedic tradition. You can argue, but really, it is. Spoken when? Just recently. 5,000 years ago. It's like yesterday. In terms of time. Just happened. In the Bhagavad Gita, which my spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, our founder Acharya, this is his translation, and it's an excellent translation. There have been many, many, many translations. 18 chapters, fourth chapter. Do you know the name of the fourth chapter in Sanskrit name? Anybody? Jnana Yoga. Jnana Yoga. The yoga of
knowledge.
The yoga of understanding. The first 14, 15 verses of the fourth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. That's all you need. That's all you need to know. If you learn that, you can close the book, go back to Godhead at the end of this life. Am I saying don't read the rest? No. Read the rest. Read all of it. I'm telling you, the first, I was just sitting there reading Bhagavad Gita one day, and the first 15 verses of the fourth chapter, it's all there. It's all there. So, will I get time to go through 15 verses? Doubt it. Let's go through a few. First verse of the fourth chapter. Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, God speaks. This is Krishna speaking to Arjuna, his friend, before the battle of Kurukshetra, before it began. Arjuna had some mixed feelings. Had some confusion. Not uncommon in the material world to become confused. We all do it from time to time. He said, Imam Vivasvate Yogam Proktavanaham Avyayam Vivasvan Manave Praha Manur Ikshvakave Bravit. He said, I instructed this imperishable science of yoga to the sun god. Vivasvan. And Vivasvan instructed it to Manu, the father of mankind. And Manu in turn instructed it to Ikshvaku. Old news, old information. That's the first thing you learn. It's been there. He taught it to the sun god. And I'm just going to read a little bit of the purport. This is Prabhupada speaking here. Herein we find the history of the Bhagavad Gita traced from a remote time when it was delivered to the royal order, the kings among all the planets. What's the number one planet among the planets? Tell me. No, in the material world. The sun. Sun, number one. Sunday, believe it or not, begins the week. Sunday. It's the first planet. And the other planets go around. So, the sun. So he spoke it to the sun god. The sun represents astrologically what the royal order represents, sovereignty, governance, leadership. Nowadays it's politicians and politics. It's who looks after the people, who organizes and takes care of the people. So who does he speak it to? He speaks it to the royal order. He speaks it to the sun god, and therefore it goes to who? All the kings, queens, princes. Why them first? Because they are responsible for the welfare of the people, period. That's why. And if they don't know this, then how will the people be looked after? This science was especially meant for the protection of the inhabitants, and therefore the royal order should understand it. In order to be able to rule the citizens and protect them from the material bondage to lust. What is lust? Is lust just desire? No. Is desire run amok? Is desire gone out of hand? Isn't it? Do people get in trouble when they when they become too lustful? Do they? Have known to. Human life is meant for cultivation of spiritual knowledge in eternal relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, with God. And the executive heads of all states and all planets are obliged. They're obliged to impart this lesson to the citizens by education, culture, and devotion. If I want to go to a school that's going to teach me virtue and good behavior, respect for God and devotion to God, and teaches me that not only is it important for me to learn material subjects and material disciplines, but it is also important for me to develop a spiritual consciousness or a higher consciousness, what school do I go to? Where do we go? Gurukul, yeah. Well, there aren't many of those, but yeah. Gurukul means just that kind of school. But where do I go here?
Temple.
There's not a lot of choices. In other words, the executive heads of all states are intended to spread the science of Krishna consciousness or God consciousness so that the people may take advantage of this great science and pursue a successful path, utilizing the opportunity of the human form of life. Human form of life is the highest form of life and gives us the opportunity to do what? Enjoy ourselves and enjoy our senses better than the animals. Yeah, well, that's true. It gives us the opportunity to raise and expand our consciousness so that we can get off the wheel of repeated birth and death. That's the human form of life. So now, a little later on in the purport, Prabhupada says, at the present moment, just so you know where this science of God consciousness fits in to the scheme of things, he says, at the present moment, we have just passed through 5,000 years of the Kali Yuga, the Iron Age, which lasts 432,000 human years. Before this, there was Dwapara Yuga, 800,000 years. Before that, Treta Yuga, 1,200,000 years, and thus some 2,005,000 years ago, Manu spoke the Bhagavad Gita to his disciple Maharaj Ikshvaku, who at that time was the king of planet Earth. 2 million years ago. The age of the current Manu is calculated to be to last some 305,300,000 years, of which 120,400,000 years have passed. Okay? So he goes on and on, and then finally he says, the Gita was spoken at least 120,400,000 years ago. What does that mean? That means this knowledge is eternal. This knowledge is always there. They say, you know, recorded history. Recorded. This is recorded history. Why don't they recognize it? Why don't they wake up and see it? Well, we didn't discover it here in the West. We are by far the most advanced civilization that's ever been on planet Earth. Don't you know that? No. Well, I know you tell me that, but I don't believe it. This is historical. In other words, in order to have a society that thrives and where everyone is treated well, it's an absolute essential element to have a culture of God consciousness integral to that society. One example, let's take one example. Yeah? There is by far, my friends, enough food being grown and produced on our planet to what? To feed who? Everyone. Correct? You see the pictures of the people in Africa suffering famine and starvation, for example. Yeah? Go to India. What is it now? 1.6 billion in India now? 1.2. Oh, okay, I'll have to reduce that figure then. Whatever, it's over a billion. Okay? Go to India. I've been there many times, all over. I don't see anybody starving. Even the poorest people are eating in India that I've seen. Have you not seen? There's plenty of food. Plenty of food. If you have a vegetarian diet, for sure you can produce enough food to feed everybody. But because there's no consciousness of this, we have starvation and we have people not having enough to eat and not enough this and that. It's simply, oh, there's not enough to grow. No. It's a misuse of resources. It's a misuse of the gifts we've been given by God. Oh, God didn't give us enough. You know, he didn't order enough in time. You know, when he placed his last order, it fell short. I don't think so. I think mismanagement is at the heart of it. And greed for a few to the detriment of the many. So, in other words, we can't have a leader, therefore we can't have a society who's not God conscious. We can't have a society where everybody gets taken care of. So then in the next verse, this supreme science was thus received through the chain of disciplic succession. The saintly kings understood it in that way. Ah, there you go. That explains it right there. Saintly kings. Okay, let's list them. Today, modern day civilization. List me the saintly kings, queens, and political leaders. Give me five, please. Come on, I'm waiting. I got time. Give me one.
Dalai Lama.
He's not a political leader. He's technically a spiritual leader. He's not a political leader. So, I'm going to say no to that only for that reason. Saintly kings. What's the word for saintly king in Sanskrit? Raja Rishi, right? What's a Raja?
King.
What's a Rishi?
King.
Sage. Saintly. An enlightened leader, correct? Come on, tell me one. What? Did I end a Kenny? Who said that? The Irish Prime Minister?
There are no saintly kings.
Well, none that I know of. There must be one or two. There must be somewhere, right? But in course of time, the succession was broken, and therefore the science as it is appears to be lost. This is what Krishna is telling Arjuna 5,000 years ago. Oh, here in the material world, things dissipate. They fall apart. They come to an end. We forget about them. That's how it is in the material world. We know that, right? Here's a little bit of the purport. It is clearly stated that the Bhagavad Gita was especially meant for the saintly kings because they were to execute its purpose in ruling over the citizens. Certainly, Bhagavad Gita was never meant for the demoniac persons who would dissipate its value for no one's benefit and would devise all types of interpretations according to their personal whims. So, and then he goes on to say that the Bhagavad Gita, well, you know, when Prabhupada was here, he used to say there were about 60 translations of the Bhagavad Gita out there on the market. I don't know what in several languages, probably. It's got to be a lot more of them now than when he was here. And a lot of them have nothing to do with the Bhagavad Gita. It's somebody running their whatever they want to say. They want to use it to influence people. Prabhupada was a follower of Gandhi when he was in university and the liberation movement in India, the emancipation movement. And in fact, they had a protest where he was to go and to the school and get his diploma for his bachelor's degree on the day that was awarded, and they did a protest and they didn't go and receive their diplomas. So even though he had passed his exams and he had received the degree, he didn't receive the degree technically because he didn't go. And that was a protest against the British government. But then Prabhupada told us that Gandhiji, for all the good he did, and he did a lot of good, so let's just say that, Gandhiji did not understand Bhagavad Gita. Even though he said Bhagavad Gita, you know, this is the book he followed all the time. He would read Bhagavad Gita. Because Bhagavad Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna, fight on the basis of religious principles. And Gandhiji says, whatever you do, never fight for anything. Never fight. It's all peace. It's not what it says in Bhagavad Gita. So there's a side note for you. Okay. Then the next verse, Krishna says, that very ancient science of the relationship with the Supreme is today told by me to you because bhakto si me saka jeti. Bhakto si me saka jeti. Because you are my devotee and my friend. You are my devotee and my friend. How do you get close to God? There it is. You can turn it around. You are my friend and my devotee. Therefore, you can understand the transcendental mystery of this science. That's what he says. This is the third verse. Because you are my friend and my devotee, you can understand. Can everybody understand this? No. I'm sorry. They can't. It's not that they can't read it. Understanding a subtlety and a transcendental philosophical understanding of that which is beyond the mundane, beyond the material, requires what? A higher consciousness. And with higher consciousness comes a higher vibration, right? A higher molecular vibration. All things actually vibrate, don't they? We don't see them like that. But there's, if you go into the physics of it, they vibrate. And things that are dense, like this table, has a very low vibration. Right? And the higher you go, the higher the vibration. A chicken, well, the chicken's vibration is there someplace, and we go higher. Human vibration, but there are humans at all these levels. So, how do you understand this knowledge? Krishna says, just become my friend. if you have a friend, will the friend not tell you whatever your friend knows? Will your friend not give you good advice? Will your friend not help you? Right? Or share what they have with you? Come to my house. I will cook you dinner. Huh? I'll make prasadam for you. That's a friend. And because this is God, my friend and my devotee. Alright? Okay. Verse 4. Arjuna said, wait, hang on a second. You know, he's not just swallowing it all. He's gone, what? The sun god Vivasvan is senior by birth to you. It's older than you. You know, the sun was in the sky when you were born, my friend. How am I to understand that in the beginning you instructed this science to him? You know, I think you're talking in riddles, my lord. And in the fifth verse, Krishna says, it's a wonderful one. It's one of my favorites. Buhuni me vyatitani janmani tavacharjuna. Many, many births both you and I have passed. I can remember them all, but you cannot. O subduer of the enemy. Gives him a compliment. He calls him subduer of the enemy. Because Arjuna is a prince, he's a warrior. So, he says, yes, I can remember all my births, but you can't. Then, in the next verse, very famous verse, Ajopi san avyayatma bhutanam ishvaropi san prakritin swam adishtaya sambhavam yatmamayaya. Very famous verse. He says, although I am unborn and my transcendental means spiritual, right? My transcendental body never deteriorates, although I am the Lord of all sentient beings, I still appear in every millennium in my original transcendental form. Well, that's pretty heavy verse, because it is dense with meaning. So he's unborn, but seemingly Krishna took birth. We know he took birth. He took birth from the womb of Devaki when Vasudev, her husband, and she were in the prison, put in the prison by her brother, Kansa, on the wedding night, no less. So years later, Krishna was born in the prison where his parents lived, right? So he has a start, seemingly. The difference is, he takes birth in many, well, we're going to get to this part, in many avatars and incarnations, God does, as needed, as required. But his birth, even though he appears like we do when we take birth, it's different. Because our bodies are made out of what? Bhumarappanalovayu kammano buddharevacha ahankar iti yangme bina prakriti rashtada. Our bodies are made out of earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intellect, ego. God's body is pure spirit. Even though it appears that he's appearing, he's being born, his body is spirit. Ours is matter. So, Prabhupada, in this little bit of this purport, says, Krishna appears in this material world in his original eternal form with two hands holding a flute. He appears exactly in his eternal body, uncontaminated by this material world. Uncontaminated or unaffected. Although he appears in the same transcendental body and is the Lord of the universe, what's the name for the Lord of the universe? Jagannath. We went to visit Jagannath just in July. It still appears that he takes his birth like an ordinary living entity. Despite the fact that Lord Krishna grows from childhood to boyhood, from boyhood to youth, like we do, astonishingly enough, he never ages beyond youth. And the rest of us are always trying to search for the fountain of youth, the magic elixir. They're always inventing new products to put on your face, aren't they, ladies? Keep you looking young. Nowadays, many gentlemen take part in this as well. It's become very much in vogue. So, at the time of the Battle of Kurukshetra, Krishna had many grandchildren at home. Oh yes. Oh yes. Or in other words, he had sufficiently aged by material calculations. Still, he looked just like a young man of 20 or 25 years old, is what Prabhupada says here. And he was a grandfather. I know a lot of grandfathers that would like to be able to do that one. Look like 20-25. We never see a picture of Krishna as an old man, do we? You ever see Krishna painted as an old guy? No. He never grows old like us, although he is the oldest person in creation, past, present, future. Neither does his body nor his intellect ever deteriorate or change, because he's God. He's transcendental. Right? Then, in the next verse, verse 7, now we're talking about the first 14 verses of the fourth chapter of Bhagavad Gita. It's everything you need to know to get through life. Says me, anyway. Text 7. Oh, another. There's so many famous verses here. What is it? Yada yadahi masya glanir bhavati bharata abhyutanam adharmasya tadatmanam srijam yam. See? It's famous. Whenever and wherever there is a decline in religious practice, O descendant of Bharata, and a predominant rise of irreligion, at that time I descend myself. Or he sends somebody. Okay? Religion here means virtue. One of Prabhupada's favorite, the word is dharma. And dharma means so many things. One of Prabhupada's favorite translations for dharma, I actually listened to a lecture he gave, as I listened to his lectures all the time, on the early part of the fourth chapter, and this verse, as a matter of fact, I listened to it, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. And he likes to translate dharma as occupational duty, oftentimes. It's also the path of virtue, the path of truth, honesty, doing your duty, doing your obligation, doing the right thing. That's dharma. Good for me, good for you, good for everybody, good for Mother Earth. That's dharma, right? Occupational duty. What's your occupational duty? Well, your occupational duty could be, if you're a woman at home, to raise your children. Maybe that's your occupational duty, to look after your family. Maybe your occupational duty is to go to work every day and do your job. maybe your occupational duty is you have this education and you've become qualified subsequently and you are out doing this occupational duty. Or you have a job that you hate, but you got to pay the bills. Is that dharma? Not exactly. We might say it's a good thing if you do your duty and you have to, bless you, pay bills and look after family, etc. We're not going to disagree with that, naturally. But if you're unhappy, is it truly your occupational duty? If you don't like the work, if the work is not reflective of who you are as a person in this lifetime, is that really occupational duty? Is that dharma? Dharma must be a reflection of the self. The dharma of sugar is sweetness. How do we separate sugar and sweetness? We can't. It's not possible. The dharma of fire is heat and light. Cannot be separated. That which cannot be separated from you is your dharma. If your occupational duty is not reflective of that, my friends, then I hope, I wish that you can make some adjustments. Anyway, so here he's talking about when people aren't acting for the benefit of the whole, religious principles, that's what he means, dharma and virtue. When the, how did he say that? When the inmates have taken over the asylum, we're all in trouble. Well, we kind of have that now, don't we? In the material world, in Kali Yuga, in so many countries. Look what's happening. Things are really, really out of hand. We're reaching a fever pitch of danger in many, many countries. You know, the U.S. seems to think that war is, well, we have to be in war perennially. War must go on forever. When does it stop? I won't get into all that. But, you know, now we have how many refugees coming in just over on boats expecting asylum? And many of them aren't even refugees. I mean, how's that all going to play out, for example? You know? So, we're in a very, very difficult time right now. Here's a little bit of the purport. Prabhupada says, therefore, each and every avatar, what's an avatar?
Incarnation
of God. Avatar means literally, means?
Descends,
comes down. That's what it means. He who comes down, or she who comes down, descends. Every avatar or incarnation of God has a particular mission, and they are all described in the revealed scriptures. No one should be accepted as an avatar unless he's referred to in scripture. It is not a fact that the Lord appears only on Indian soil. Well, only Indians can be avatars? No. He can advent himself anywhere and everywhere and whenever he desires to appear. In each and every incarnation, he speaks as much about religion as can be understood by the particular people under their particular circumstances. Oh. He speaks only as much as they can process in their current environment and circumstances. Thou shalt not kill. Do you need to be told that? Do you actually need to be told, don't kill anybody, it's not good? Did your parents tell you when you were child, don't go, whatever you do, don't kill anybody? Did your mom tell you that at some point? No, she said, put that thing away, somebody's going to lose an eye. That's what she said. It's a little different, right, huh? We all know that one. So what is the level of consciousness when you have to tell somebody, thou shalt not kill? It's not that high. Thou shalt not steal. You know, you're not supposed to take something that belongs to somebody else. Do you know that? It's not yours. And they won't be happy if you take it from them. Do you need to know that? He speaks on the level that you can process. We're processing on a bit of a higher level here, or at least we're trying to, right? But the mission is the same, to lead people to God consciousness and obedience to the principles of Dharma. Sometimes he descends personally, sometimes he sends his bona fide representative in the form of his son, servant, or himself in some disguised form. Or he sometimes empowers another, like a regular human, seemingly. He can also do that, can he not? And next verse. And we're moving along nicely here. Text 8. Very famous one. There's so many famous verses in here. Paritranaya sadunam vinashaya chidushkritam dharma samstampanartaya sambhavami yuge yuge. So what does that one mean? In order to deliver the pious, the good people, the honest people, and to annihilate the miscreants, the rogues, the thieves, the dacoits. Prabhupada, you like that word, he's the dacoits. Here, Haribo, here they you say gurriers, right? What does gurrier mean? Is it just a thief or
roughnecks,
yeah, troublemakers. As well as to reestablish the principles of religion. I advent myself millennium after millennium. Millennium after yuge, a yuga. This is Kali Yuga. 432,000 years. The one before Dwapar Yuga, 864,000 years. So for sure, at least once in a yuga after yuga, millennium after millennium. I mean, who talks like that? Who tells you, I'll be here 500,000 years from now. You will see me again. But I won't be in this form. Okay, is all you would say. If a human said that to you, right? Here's a little bit of the purport. Prabhupada says, the Lord has many agents who are quite competent to vanquish demons, but the Lord especially descends to appease his unalloyed devotees, who are always harassed by the demoniac. The demon harasses the devotee even though the latter may happen to be his kin. He gives the example. Although Prahlad Maharaj was the son of Hiranyakashipu, he was nonetheless persecuted by his father. Correct? Although Devaki, the mother of Krishna, was the sister of Kamsa, she and her husband, Vasudev, were persecuted only because Krishna was to be born to them. Right? So Lord Krishna appeared primarily to what? This is interesting what he says here. Lord Krishna appeared primarily to deliver Devaki rather than kill Kamsa. Oh, I thought he appeared to kill Kamsa to remove the demon, remove the problem. No, he appeared for the protection of Devaki, his devotee. Why? Because God always loves and protects his devotee. That's his motivation. Oh, I must go. I must protect my devotee. How will I do it? Well, I'm going to have to kill this guy, Kamsa, who's a troublemaker and who's causing all these problems. We should mention that Kamsa was on the throne at that time, but he did not gain the throne through proper means. He usurped the throne from Ugrasen, right? So he, when Krishna comes, when God comes, or the avatar comes, he performs both simultaneously. Kills the demon and protects the devotee. Therefore, it is said here that to deliver the devotee and vanquish the demon, the Lord appears in different incarnations. Okay. Oh, this next verse. Oh, it's absolutely one of the most wonderful verses. Oh, you know it. I know you do. Janma karma cha me divyam evam yo veti tatvatah chaktva deham punar janma naiti mam iti sorjuna. We can stop right there, my friends, because that's the one. This is Krishna. One who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities does not, upon leaving the body, upon death, take his birth again in this material world, but attains my eternal abode, Arjuna. What? It's that simple? No. He must be joking. One who knows the transcendental nature of my appearance and activities. Janma, karma, chame, divyam. Janma is birth, karma is work, activities, what he does. Me means my, divyam means divine, transcendental. What, just to know that he does it? No. To believe that God is capable of doing things that are beyond the human pale, beyond the human experience. To believe that what God does is divine, godly, and transcendental in every degree. And to genuinely and truly believe that. Not just, yeah, okay, makes sense. Makes sense. That's good if you think that. But if you believe it at the point of death, then he says, let me read it from here, it's easier. Tyaktva deham, upon giving up the body, punar janma na eti. Another, punar janma means another birth, na eti, he does not take. And then he says, Mom, A.T., he comes to me. He comes to me. He does not take another birth. That's how straightforward it is, how simple it is. And that is an absolutely wonderful verse. Now this next one has philosophy from here to there in it. I mean, it is so expansive and far-reaching. It's the very next verse. Vitaraga baya krodha manmaya mamupasrita bahavo jnana tapasa puta madbhavam agata. Okay. Being freed from attachment, fear, and anger, being fully absorbed in me and taking refuge in me, many, many persons in the past became purified by knowledge of me. And thus, they all attained transcendental love for me. Wow. He says that many, many people have achieved transcendence in the past. They've gotten off the wheel of repeated birth and death, sorrow, suffering, loss. Well, how did they do it? Is there a secret? Is there a trick? It's all there. Vita raga baya krodha. That's it. Vita means to be freed from it. To have it lifted from you. Raga baya krodha. Raga is attachment. It's mine. I deserve it. I need to have it. Attachment. Can't let go. Bhaya is fear. Oh, what if this doesn't happen? What if that happens? Oh my God, I need to do something. I need to control some things because what this can't happen. Or, what other kind of fear? What are these people going to do to me? I'm in danger. Or, krodha, anger. In what sense? When I don't get what I want, frustrated desire leads to anger. Right? Now, this purport is, it's seminal. It's so expansive what it contains. So let's read some of it. As described above, it is very difficult for a person who is too materially affected to understand the personal nature of the Supreme Absolute Truth. If you're too attached materially, you won't understand. Because that's not what's typically on your mind. You're thinking always about material things connected to the body. Generally, people who are attached to the bodily conception of life are so absorbed in materialism that it's almost impossible for them to understand that there is a transcendental body which is imperishable, full of knowledge, and eternally blissful. Whose body? Your body. Your body, your spiritual body. Why does he describe it like this? Imperishable, full of knowledge, eternally blissful. Ooh, what is that? What's the Sanskrit for that? Sat Chit Ananda. That is imperishable. Sat. Never dies. It's Chit. It is full of knowledge and ananda, eternally blissful. In the material concept, the body is perishable, full of ignorance, and completely miserable. You might want to argue that. Well, I'm not completely miserable. I'm happy. Yeah, you can be happy for a while, for a time. You can also be sad. We can go up and down. Therefore, people in general keep this same bodily idea in mind when they are informed of the personal form of God. Personal form of God as a person. How do you have a friendship if between you and some energy? Wouldn't it be easier to have a friendship between you and another person? Suppose you go to my house, and everything in my house will remind you of me because it's my house. But I'm not there. You just hang out in my house, and I never come there. Are you having a personal relationship with me? No. You're having an impersonal relationship with my house. With my energy. Correct? And because they are too materially absorbed, the conception of retaining the personality after liberation from matter frightens them. What's the point here? Many people relate to being a person, that may not be you, it may be some of you, as being, it's so hard here. It is so difficult even being in the material world. What do the philosophers call that? The existential malaise. You know what the existential malaise is? We all experience it from time to time. And it's this. What's wrong, honey? I don't know. Well, your career's going along nicely. I know. You got everything you want. Heck, I just bought you a new car last year. I know, I love the car. What's wrong? I don't know. I don't know what's wrong. I can't point to anything and say it's wrong. I don't know. That is the existential malaise. When you can't point to something, it's easy. When you can say, oh, well, this just happened in my life, and now I'm in anxiety, I'm stressed. Yeah, of course. We all know that. When everything's fine, but it's not fine. That's what we're talking about. There are many people, and people who suffer from depression, mild depression, despondency, God bless, that don't want to even think like there's going to be another body and another identity. Just get me out of here. Oh, I don't want that. I just want to merge. I want to disappear. I want to just let it all go. That's kind of what he's referring to right here. They're afraid of becoming persons again, so they naturally prefer a kind of merging into the impersonal void. Generally, they compare the living entities to the bubbles of the ocean, which merge into the ocean. That is the highest perfection of spiritual existence attainable without an individual personality. This is a kind of fearful stage of life. I'm afraid. Devoid of perfect knowledge of spiritual existence. Furthermore, there are other persons who cannot understand spiritual existence at all. Being embarrassed by so many theories and by contradictions of various types of philosophical speculation, they become disgusted or angry and foolishly conclude that there is no supreme cause and that everything is ultimately void. Recently, a member of the government who sits in the cabinet of the government here said, there's one thing I know for sure, and that is there is no God. God does not exist. I know this absolutely without question. And he wasn't even the minister for religion, by the way. Okay. How do I know? Let me tell you how I know. Because any God would never let happen what goes on in this world. He would never let that happen. What kind of God would that be? Therefore, I know there's no such thing as God. God bless this gentleman. What kind of train of logic is it? Well, you've heard it before. You've heard it from lots of people. It's not new. God wouldn't let this happen. If he's the all-powerful, all-loving, all-compassionate being he's supposed to be, he wouldn't let this happen. Yes, my friend, it all sounds very nice, except this is the material world where you come to play out your karma. Action, reaction. Why are these people suffering? Hey, well, let's go into their past life here and check and see what they did. Well, I don't believe in a past life. Well, okay. There we go then. Therefore, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in karma. I don't believe in reincarnation. I don't believe in anything. Okay. That's why you're so angry. Vita raga baya krodha. Angry. Alright. Or there's another explanation. Baladev Vidyabhushan, who's a very famous commentator, Prabhupada quotes him all the time. And here, he gives a bit of a different translation of this verse. He says, having given up attachment, fear, and anger toward those who do not believe in my eternal nature. So now he's thrown it back in your lap and saying, Oh, you believe in God. You're a devotee. You're devotional. You have a relationship with God. You have to give up your attachment to how you think things should be. Well, things shouldn't be like this. Things should be, and in fact, that's how I've been talking, haven't I? At the beginning, I say, things shouldn't be like this in this world. That's what I was saying. Am I guilty of this? Well, maybe. Give up your attachment to how things are. If, because you don't like it. I don't like it like that. Okay. You don't have to like it. But you can't be attached to not liking it. That's the point. Give up your attachment toward and fear. Fear of what? Fear of, well, let's read his little purport. Baladeva Vidyabhushan. He says, because this knowledge of my eternal birth and activities arises only by analysis of the difficult passages. Okay, no, that's the austerity part. Okay. I'll get to that. So, you give up your attachment, your fear of being afraid of people who don't think like you think. And your anger at people who don't think like you think. Your expectation of what everybody's supposed to be and do. And let none of it, what? Bother you. Affect you. When you can do that, you're there. Vita raga paya krodha. You've given up attachment, fear, anger. I'm not afraid. What's the worst that could happen to me? I could die. And then I wouldn't be dead. I'd either get another body or I'd return to the spiritual world. Anger. Do I ever get angry? Unfortunately, yes, I do. Still too much of that human blood going through the veins, you know. A lot less than I used to. So that's good. Why do we get angry? Because this guy cut me off on the highway. Or this person did this, or this person said that, or I'm giving my tax money to this shower of people to spend it on what? Well, there's a good reason. So, giving up attachment, fear, and anger, that's how you get to God. That's what he says, right there. Then he says, the next verse, up to verse 11, probably ended here. Ye yata mam prapadyante tangs titaiva pajamiham mamubartman vartante manushya parta sarvashaha. What does he say there? He says, as they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. What does that mean? You reciprocate with God, he reciprocates with you. You pay attention to him, he pays attention to you. You can't just go, God, why is this happening to me? It shouldn't be happening. And then the rest of the time, ignore him. Too busy, sorry. No, I got all this stuff to do later. Huh? But as soon as something happens, you don't. I thought you were my friend. All right? No. That's not how it works. Friendship, hello. Reciprocation, two-way street, exchange. He doesn't ignore somebody. You know, one of your friends calls you up, you haven't heard him from in a year. Say, by the way, can I borrow your car? Can I borrow $50? You know, who is this again? No, I don't know any John. No, sorry. No. It's a reciprocation. And then Krishna says, everyone follows my path in all respects. Whatever path you're following, one way or the other, whatever this, what this means without reading it is, whatever conception of God you have, it doesn't have to be Krishna. It could be Rama, it could be Nrsimha, it could be Allah. It could be Yahweh, it could be Jehovah. Whatever conception you choose to follow in this lifetime, He will clear the way for you. He will reciprocate with you in that way. As long as you're making effort and we're making progress, that's it. That's all that's required. So God will take you in whatever way you want to approach. He accepts that. I mean, what more can you say? What more do you want? He'll accept what, if one offers, patram pushpam phalam, a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water. He didn't ask for a golden crown, which costs a lot. A leaf, a flower, fruit, or water. Make this offering to me. A little stick of incense. We do it. That's what we do. He says, I'll accept it. That's it. So we take a step closer. This is Jnana Yoga chapter. Only a small part. That's all you need. If you know these things and you have faith, you have Shraddha, you have the belief underneath, we're done here. We're finished. You don't have to come back here. You want to come back here? No problem. Your choice, my friends. Thousands of lifetimes. I'm getting weary of all these lifetimes. I'm getting weary. I'd like to get out of here. Go back to Vrindavan, where all the fun is happening. All the dancing, all the singing, all the playing on musical instruments. Vrindavan. Krishna and the gopis, Radha, Balaramji. So, we're going to chant so we can dance, and then we're going to have vegetarian food, prasadam, offered to Krishna. And I thank you for your kind attention. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Questions?
Yes, I have a question.
Hello?
Were there many scholars or people who Prabhupada valued their interpretation of the Bhagavad Gita?
Yes.
There was.
Well, there was Sridhar Swami, there was Baladev Vidyabhushan, there was Vishwanath Chakravarti. There was Bhaktivinoda Thakur. There was Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. That's only five that I can think of right now. Those are some of the main ones. There are more. Sadhu Shastra Guru. That's what Prabhupada taught us. Shastra is the Vedas. The Word. In the beginning was the Word. Where does it say that? The Bible. That's right. The Word. So that's Shastra. Sadhu. Realized souls, enlightened souls, sages, rishis. There's many of them that are talked about. and ones that have done commentaries, Smriti, on all of the Shastras, scriptures, and guru. Why do you need a guru? Can you approach God without a guru? Sure you can. Of course you can. Why even bother then with a guru? What's the benefit? What's the need? Because we get waylaid. We get sidetracked. We get confused. We get bewildered. The guru goes, here, and I'll, let's get you back on track here, my friend. I was thinking on this. No, never mind about all that. Here you go now. That's what the guru is for. When you start to, I like to explain to people, life purpose or dharma, that's your main road. Everybody has a life purpose. Everybody. Different. But we stay on the main road, and hopefully spirituality is an integral part of that life purpose. There we go. But what do? Assume, let me go off on a bit of a tangent here. Let's go over and do this for a while. Let's go over and get into this darkness over here for a while, because that's fun. Okay, so you had this experience, that experience. Did you come back? We know what happens. It's not whether you did it. It's, did you come back? What did you learn? Are you back on track? Are you back on the road to your dharma? That's the main thing. Don't beat yourself up because you went off and did this and that. And I didn't want to do it, but I did it. I enjoyed it. I hate myself. Never mind all that. Never mind all that. Forget about it. Don't persecute yourself till the end of time. Just come back. Let it go. Forget about it. Get back. Focus on the goal. Focus on Krishna. Focus on why you're here. What you're here to do. Never mind all this other stuff. You know what they say? What's the saying? The dogs will bark, the jackals will howl, and the caravan just passes by. The caravan just keeps going. You're the caravan. You just keep going. Never mind the dogs and the jackals who are going like this and calling you this, and forget them. They're not part of your dharma, are they? No, but they... never mind. It's not part of your dharma. Forget them. They're sucking the air out of the room, those people. Huh? Any other questions? Well then, chanting, dancing. Hare Krishna.